Welcome to episode 2 of Respiratory Life. Respiratory Life is the new video and audio podcast from the European Respiratory Society Respiratory Channel, your new and relaunched go-to place for all things educational at the ERS. Respiratory Life is a podcast about respiratory medicine, but particularly about the stuff that happens about respiratory medicine. And thank you for joining us. And I'm joined again today by Breda Cushion. Hello, Breda.
Hi, Brian.
By Laura Gleason. Hello, Laura.
Hello, Brian.
And by our resident Luce Cannon, as described by Laura's dad, Imran Suleiman. Hello, Imran.
Salutations, Brian.
There you go, Luce Cannon. Welcome back. I'm slightly surprised they let us do another episode. In fact, they're letting us do at least 2 more episodes. So, yeah.
Crazy.
Hold on to your horses. So today we're going to be, I'll get into the meat of this in a minute, but we're going to be talking a bit about peer review. But something we're going to be featuring at the beginning of our episodes and for the next little while is we're going to be talking a little bit about stuff that one of us has seen or read over the last few days before we record. And I thought I'd lead off with that about an interesting paper I'd seen this week. Largely because it vindicates some biases I had, which I think you'll all agree, and we'll come back to this in a little while, is the most important thing about evidence. And what I wanted to briefly touch on is a paper from the Lancet Respiratory Medicine, just published a few days ago, from Alan Arnstultz and about 11,000 other authors, which is a systematic review, an individual patient data meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials of remdesivir in patients with COVID-19. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I vividly recall helping to run our COVID unit, particularly kind of January, February 2021, when things were really, really bad and lots of people were coming in with very severe COVID pneumonias. And there were some things we could do for them. We could give them steroids. We could give them respiratory support with various different devices. That you know, including plastic moustaches, of course.
Brian's favorite.
But from a pharmacotherapy point of view, we were pretty limited. Now, one drug we had access to, but it was relatively tightly controlled access, was remdesivir. And at that point in time, it wasn't clear whether remdesivir really did a whole lot. There was a study called the ACT-1 study, which you guys will probably remember from mainly from the US, but also from some other international centers, which showed that it was capable of shortening duration of people's illness, particularly if they're on supplemental oxygen. But there wasn't any, you know, particularly convincing data showing a reduction in mortality. And there certainly wasn't consensus on whether the drug was something that was useful. Was it something that you guys used much at the time?
Yeah, we used quite a bit of it, both in Beaumont and also in the States, particularly at NYU. They had a big Ebola center. So we had a lot of access to remdesivir and a lot of it. So we used it pretty freely in the States. And then when I came back, we used it a good bit as well.
I was a big fan of it. And the main reason I was a big fan of it was because I suppose, first of all, there's a kind of intervention bias where you feel like you're doing something by treating people. But also, I thought purely on the basis of a study that shows that it gets people better faster. You guys will recall how much pressure we were under in terms of accommodating people, just in terms of numbers of beds at the time. And I just thought, all right, if we can get someone out after 7 days instead of after 10 days, then that's going to really, really improve our throughput. But, you know, a lot of my colleagues who are far smarter and more capable and frankly better doctors than I am would have not felt the same way. And, you know, not necessarily everyone would have been given the medication. Anyway, it turns out as time has gone by and as the pandemic has receded, but it looks like it probably is a worthwhile treatment. And this meta-analysis looked at aggregate data, actually individual patient data, excuse me, of just over 10,000 patients. What we see in that cohort is that if you give people remdesivir when they're hospitalized with COVID and they need a bit of oxygen, then it looks like it's a pretty good drug. It looks like it reduces mortality by about 20% in relative terms and about a couple of percent in absolute terms. I guess it's very difficult to look at numbers needed to treat now because things have changed a lot in terms of I was in an immunologically naive population, so it's probably a little bit different now. But back then, probably would have looked at a number needed to treat about somewhere between 30 and 50 to save one life. Where it doesn't work at all is in the people who've gotten bad enough that they need to go to ICU for for supportive ventilation. It looks like, if anything, that it's a slightly funny signal, but the data trend towards harm there.
Just similar to the anticoagulation story as well.
Yeah,
right?
I guess so. Yeah, exactly.
Is there a timing, you know, is it only if the COVID was acquired within X number of days before hospitalization, or was that looked at?
Yeah, know, there's a bit of heterogeneity in the signal there. And like, not all of the studies really accurately captured that. I suppose, you know, where we were able to more accurately look at things is the amount that the level of respiratory support people were needing. And that seems to be the clearest signal as to who will benefit from it and who won't. So, I mean, hopefully nowadays everyone's seeing a lot less COVID pneumonia than they were, but it's still knocking about a bit and we're still seeing people coming in. And I kind of think that if we're seeing people coming in and they need a bit of oxygen for some COVID, then I think giving them some of this drug is probably worthwhile. The safety signals look pretty clean. So there you go. There's some vindication for me. So yeah.
And it's nice to see like all of the like smaller trials kind of combined together in one kind of overarching kind of consensus at the end of
years
of experimental use.
I think there's probably no need for further randomized controlled trials of this drug at this point. Anyway, what we agreed we would spend today talking about is peer review. And how studies like the ones we've just talked about end up going from action in the real world to being turned into papers, which then get assessed and published in leading journals like that. Imran, before we outline the importance of peer review or where we think it fits, could you just outline what tends to happen now when somebody submits a paper to a journal? Just talk through the process of what it involves.
Yeah, so the process is pretty consistent amongst most journals. So you submit your manuscript with whatever figures and tables you want with it. And then you might, in some journals, you might nominate reviewers that you want to review your paper, or in some cases, suggest reviewers that you don't want to review your paper. It then goes to the editor of the journal, who then allocates it to an associate editor. And then it's up to the associate editor to review the paper, make sure that it's okay, and then pick some people to review the paper. You can go by people that have been suggested by the authors or people that you know that might have some interest in the topic of the manuscript, and or there is some journals have a search function built within the journal facility itself. Then it goes out to the reviewers, and then there can be a lengthy period while the reviewers either are reviewing the paper, haven't got to reviewing the paper, eventually potentially might say that they don't have time to review the paper, and then you have to find another reviewer. So that can lengthen that period of time quite significantly. And then eventually when you get enough reviewer responses back, the associate editor looks through the reviews and decides whether the paper is acceptable as it is, which most of the case it's not, whether it needs minor revisions, major revisions, or whether it needs to be rejected. And then it goes back to the primary author.
So, I think one thing that's common for most journals, not all journals, is that process is single-blinded, correct? Whereby the authors won't know who's reviewing their paper, but the reviewers will often know who the authors are.
Yeah, and so I think some journals give the reviewer the option to publicize who they are to the author if they want to.
In an ideal world, what you're talking about is relatively constrained timelines whereby, you know, the paper is submitted, an editor looks at it within a day or two and sends it to an associate editor who looks at it within a day or two, who then recruits a couple of peer reviewers very quickly, who then will have their comments back within 10 to 14 days. But that never happens, does it? Okay, so we'll come back to that in a minute. It has become the cornerstone of how we decide what counts as real science, though. It has become the cornerstone of how we establish what treatments are worthwhile, what kind of approaches to patient care are worthwhile. So I want to, in a little while, what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about whether it actually works and what the potential upsides and downsides of it are and what other approaches to data and evidence might be available. But I'm really interested in your own experiences of peer review from slightly different aspects of it. So, Brita, you've published loads of papers. Can you tell us about how you've, you know, how it's gone for you when you've sent somebody in. As an author, what does the process feel like?
I think some things that have been mentioned already can be quite a lengthy process sometimes. So I suppose as an author, you're kind of can be waiting quite a while for to get the responses back. I think the peer review as an author, it's interesting and it's helpful to get other people's perspectives on your work. And I think overall, in most cases, it does strengthen your paper. But sometimes I found that the reviewers, you know, you could have very conflicting reviews, or one reviewer might pick out something that the other doesn't, or the other doesn't have an issue with. And sometimes it can be challenging to address that and to please, I suppose, all the reviewers when you're responding to them, if they have conflict. And sometimes I feel that that may be due to the reviewer's own interest in a specific topic, or maybe there might be some inherent biases that they have that they want you to address. So that aspect of it can be very challenging, especially when you're trying to respond to the reviewers and kind of, I suppose, please everybody.
Another thing that kind of convolutes the review process, I don't know if you've experienced this, Brian, generally most papers need at least two reviews or reviewers, and you might get two that are very conflicting. And then adding to the length of time, you might need a third reviewer. And then and on top of that, some journals have a statistical editor, which is a fourth reviewer. And then the associate editor is the fifth reviewer. And that's a lot.
So from an author's perspective, as Imran says, depending on what journal you go to, you may end up with anywhere between two and five sets of reviews to respond to.
Yeah.
What happens if some reviewer says something stupid? Because frankly, they do. Lots of the time. So like, what do you do when someone has completely missed the point and come out with some daft suggestion? Like, how do you deal with that?
It's really challenging because I suppose, you know, sometimes you feel you have to kind of get past this reviewer. You want to get your paper published, so you don't want to insult them, you know, because that might lead to you not, you know, your paper being rejected. So I do find that really challenging, actually. And sometimes I suppose it's acknowledging their the point that they've made and then just trying to argue your point, I suppose, in as kind of non-confrontational a way as possible, or not making them think that you think that whatever has been said is stupid. But I do think it's... It can be really challenging. And that's when, like when Imran said there, when you get conflicting reviewers as well, it can be really challenging to address that.
Laura, what makes you say yes or no to review a paper? Hey, let me write this down, because I mean...
It's actually an interesting question, because I think, you know, like, what's the incentive for peer reviewer to like act as a reviewer? Is it altruism and like dedication to science?
Well, what are your motivations?
Yeah, well, this is what I'm saying. So I think probably like that idea that like you're kind of building relationships, and then also if it's like something that does look particularly interesting and like related to something that I'm like working on myself, I think then you're interested to know what that other group is doing, and you might as well be kind of like examining their paper in detail to kind of find out more about it. So I think that's why I would, they're my two main motivations for being interested in it.
Do you set time aside? Do you just try and wedge it into things? What do you do?
Well, I would usually try and do it within a couple of weeks, because I don't like having things hanging over me. But I'd say I would definitely spend about like maybe 5 hours ish if I was doing a review, either in like a couple of afternoons in a row or a couple of evenings in a row, probably. I would say.
So it's a substantial time commitment.
Yeah. I mean, it would vary, like, depending on what the paper was. But that's what I would say. And I think the things that I find challenging about it then are sometimes, like, a lot of the stuff that I would look at is, like, very heavily kind of science-based. And sometimes if they're using techniques I'm not that familiar with, you know, I find that kind of challenging to, it actually takes a bit of reading to understand what they're even, you know, doing, you know, which kind of throws into the whole thing of whether I should be, I'm the most appropriate person to be reviewing the paper in the first place.
If you look at the numbers involved in peer review, I think it's understandable almost why it's so difficult. You know, it's estimated there's somewhere in the region of 30,000 journals publishing stuff. Some of those journals are amazing, some of them are terrible, some of them are in between. And those 30,000 journals are putting out somewhere in the region of 4 million papers per year. Not all of those papers will be peer reviewed, obviously, but let's say, assume that even half of those papers are peer reviewed. You're talking about an immense workload. And, you know, there is data looking at how much work is done in peer review, and the numbers are staggering. So we're talking about somewhere in the region of 100 million person hours per year is put into peer review. Thank you.
Whoa.
I thought that number needed, some appreciation. If you turn that into years, it's 15,000 person years per year of work goes into peer review. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of people. There are only so many, you know, clinicians and scientists out there, and they are being asked to do a hell of a lot of work. And most of that work is well, at least quasi-altruistic. Mm-hmm. You know, yes. It's certainly voluntary in the monetary sense of it, even if people have perhaps their own agenda behind doing it. But like, you're talking about a staggering amount of work that has to be done. We're going to come back in a couple of minutes as to whether it does have to be done. Ooh. You guys are all going to say yes, and I think that's probably fair. But like, you know, nonetheless, I suppose. So we've talked a bit about the different aspects of the process and the sort of challenges involved. I suppose a fundamental question is, does it work? Is peer review successful at taking, I was going to call it raw data, but let's say, just call it unprocessed or previously unexamined information that people have developed and are putting out there? Is it good at taking that and bringing that through a process that allows it to be more appropriate for public consumption?
I would argue yes. Okay. I think it's basically like what you're doing with peer review is you're trying to get somebody who has a particular expertise in the field to interpret the data that's being put in front of them and say, yes, this is valid or this isn't valid. And it's assuming that the people that you're asking to peer review have an expertise that other people don't. And whether you might be talking about within the medical profession, these people have a niche area that they have expertise in, and then they're going to help interpret the data for the masses before it's distributed. If you're asking if it's consistent, no, it's not. And if you're asking if it's foolproof, no, it's not. But like, the concept behind it, like, I mean, there's way too much data that comes out for every single person to be able to individually go through each paper and figure out if they think it's, you know, appropriate mm-hmm. or not. Like, you are asking people with expertise in specific fields to be kind of a gate or something before it comes through.
I think that's a good moment to talk about limitations of it, though. And we kind of touched on this a little bit when you were talking about whether you might review a paper or not. But how much do you think the identity of, for example, the people writing the paper impacts upon the likelihood of positive peer review? Are you conscious of biases when you're reviewing a paper?
One of the big challenges of peer review is, for certain areas, you have a small group of people that know each other well, that are co-collaborators a lot of the time, and that review each other's work. And Imran, you mentioned that, you know, when someone submits a paper to a journal, often there's an opportunity to nominate reviewers. So you're obviously nominating people that are, you know, positive. Will be likely to give you a more favorable review. So it can create this kind of little kind of pocket of elitism. And then it's hard for like early career researchers to kind of break into it, or people who are kind of from groups that haven't been researching in that field before and stuff like that, to break into this gang. So I think there is a challenge. And, you know, if somebody who has like a big track record and a lot of like prestige behind them has written a paper, I'm sure that people are more likely to give them a favorable review versus an unknown person, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, that is true.
Yeah, I mean, there's a pretty good evidence base at this stage showing very clear demonstration of prestige bias, where, you know, someone who's won a Nobel Prize is, even if they submit some nonsense, is far more likely to get published in a journal than somebody who's a non-known entity. There's also reasonably good evidence of a degree of gender bias, that men find it easier to get published. And there's a degree of cultural bias seen as well. Like, if you use a single paper and you suggest to reviewers that it's from one part of the world versus another part of the world, papers from kind of established developed world are much more likely to get accepted.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of potential biases that feed in there.
And there's biases with the editors as well. So it's not just with the reviewers. So if your paper maybe is on some novel concept or maybe something that's slightly going against what the accepted thinking is, it is harder because the reviewers and sometimes the editors as well, if they're in that area, have their own bias. It's just if you're trying to challenge that, the kind of thinking. So a lot of those papers from the 19, you know, all those Einstein papers are, you know, all those big breakthroughs in medicine, I'm sure if a lot of them have gone through peer review, they, you know, they would have been rejected. So
how do we make it work better?
I do think, I mean, yeah, so you have to work harder. You might get a tougher time from reviewers if you're doing, saying something that's breaking the mold or that's going against the status quo. But like, also, you know, there is a bigger like kind of burden of proof required if you're trying to go against the status quo and against what's already been published and verified. And I know sometimes we're following, you know, things that have just been set in stone without maybe the firmest foundation. But it makes sense that people will stand up and pay attention and go through things with a fine tooth comb more when you're trying to say something that goes against what we believe already.
So a number of approaches have been suggested to try and take away some of these biases and to try and kind of level the playing field a bit when it comes to peer review. One of them is open peer review. How would you guys feel if you were a reviewer? Would you be happy having your reviews published, first of all? And secondly, you know, open to having the authors aware of who you are? Does that, is that something that would make you more or less hesitant to agree to peer review?
I'd be happy doing it.
Yeah, I know.
I'm similar. Actually, I think maybe as an author, having the reviewers blinded to me as an author, but me knowing who they are is fairer than the other way around, which is what the standard is.
Yeah.
You know, because as a reviewer, I mean, you're meant to be critically evaluating a paper and try not to, you know, try to be as impartial as possible. So why would you not want the authors to know who you are?
Put an editorial hat on. I suppose my concern would be, my concern with open peer review is that it might limit people's willingness to criticize work that may not be up to standard if the people whose work they're criticizing are established leaders in their field or people that they know well or, you know, or acquaintances or that they might be have collaborations with. So, you know, what we think about it as being something that takes away people's ability to be rude to each other, it might actually attenuate legitimate criticism and take that away a little bit.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, that's true. But I think if the reviewers didn't know who wrote the paper, then that's...
So would you double blind papers then? So at the moment, as we've said at the beginning, like most papers are single blinded in the sense that the reviewer knows whose paper it is. Would you take that away? Would you just send the paper out to the reviewers without the reviewers knowing who the author is? Do you think that's a helpful approach?
I think it would address some of the things that we've brought up in terms of biases and, you know, institutional bias or, you know, knowing the authors where maybe you're going to go a bit easier on them. So it would certainly take that away. I think it would be hard to have something totally blinded because even in your methods, you're going to describe where this piece of work took place. You know, it can be easy. Or if it's a registered clinical trial, for example, you just have to go on to clinical trials and you find out, you know, who's the researcher. So it is difficult to totally blind, but I do think there are merits in the reviewers not knowing the authors in terms of trying to eliminate some of the biases.
Difficult area in terms of evidence that there's quite a lot of conflicting data on whether double blinding papers leads to reductions in publication bias, with some trials suggesting that it does and others suggesting the neutral effect. So, and I think part of the problem there is that you can't blind everybody. So if Imran or I get a paper and we send it out to you to be reviewed and you don't know who the authors is, we do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe they hang out with Imran at his death metal clubs, you know? And like, so, you know, it's difficult to eliminate bias, that way.
Yeah, and like what you said as well, like a lot of authors and PIs have very particular styles of writing and particular styles of figures. Like it's very easy sometimes to pick them out.
Particularly in small fields.
Yeah.
And you might know what their model is and things like that in a small field as well.
I mean, you give a lot of time. I have to say you're a lot more diligent than I am. Maybe that reflects the different types of papers that we review. But, you know, you said about 5 hours for a lot of papers. Do you think you should be paid for that time? Do you think that would lead to better peer review?
I don't think a payment would be an incentive. Like, I don't feel like I would see payment as a real incentive to do it, you know what I mean? And I think when you talk about the volume of work that's being done, is it reasonable that we would pay for that? Like, who would pay for it?
What makes a professional reviewer a good reviewer?
No, exactly.
Like none of us are trained how to review a paper, right?
Well, it turns out that if you train people, you can do that. You can train people. You can train physicians. You can train other clinicians. You can train lay people. But it doesn't really necessarily translate into higher quality review, which is ultimately what the goal would be. Yeah.
And the whole idea of the peer review process, again, is like getting experts in that specific niche area to look at this paper or this data. So the idea of training up people to like do generic peer review is kind of like, I mean, sure, it's probably helpful if everybody gets some sort of like basic skill set, but you're really being asked for your expert opinion. Yeah. That's what you're being asked
for. But that's obviously the ideal. You want the people who have the most knowledge about this topic to be reviewing the paper and critiquing it. But sometimes you just can't get the reviewers. So, that's the challenge.
Just generically able to do peer review might be
or
a
often
good alternative.
You get back reviews from people who have no idea what they're, reviewing in the topic of your field, right?
Yeah.
Say for like microbiome stuff, we might get back reviews and people that don't really understand the microbiome stuff, but they're able to review a paper from a grammatical point of view, which is not what you're looking for.
You said something there because you were talking about potentially publishing the reviews and we kind of talked about, having the reviewers non-anonymous. But like, what about that idea of just publishing the review beside the paper as well? Like, I think that's not a bad idea.
Well, I was about to, what I was going to come to is, what are the alternatives to traditional peer review? I mean, if we slightly skirt around the modifications to peer review that we've just discussed, are there other ways of approaching this? And maybe that's one of them. So the journal eLife has, since I think middle of last year, been accepting all papers that it has peer reviewed. So it accepts everything. It has decided that its job in life is not to act as an arbiter of what counts as high quality work, but instead to act as a forum for work to be read and assessed. All papers still get peer reviewed, but the reviews are published alongside the author's manuscript. So the reviewer doesn't say, no, you can't publish this. The paper gets published, but the review sits there and lives beside the manuscript. So readers can go read the manuscript and go, okay, that sounds interesting. Then read the reviews and go, oh no, actually that isn't interesting, that's insane. And it ultimately boils down to then that there will be public peer review, that ultimately it's the readers who are the arbiters of whether that is something that will be taken forward or not. I mean,
but the readers of the reviews, though.
Of both the paper and the reviews.
Yeah, but they're being biased by the review, right? Say, for example, another way of doing this is MedArchive or BioArchive.
Yeah.
You just put your article there. There's no reviews, but like it's up to the vitriol of Twitter or Reddit, for example, for all the COVID stuff that came out, was being reviewed by people from all over the world that had potentially no background in science or medicine, which is different from this, though, because that reader has the paper and potentially some experts reviewing it, right? So,
I mean, you have a responsibility if you're like publishing something on a platform that, you're not putting false information out there, and it seems like they're not making any effort to prevent that from happening. Like, they're abdicating that responsibility that they have as a publishing forum. I don't know if I agree with that.
But do you think that every paper that's gone through peer review and has been accepted for publication doesn't, that they are all true and
no,
nothing that's
I
in
don't
them
at
is
all,
false.
But at least like an effort is being made. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Whereas in that case, it's like they're just saying it's not our place to judge. When actually, if you're publishing it, it kind of is your place, making some effort to make sure
nonetheless,
it's accurate.
As Breeda says, loads of really bad stuff that's published, including stuff that is frankly just made up and fraudulent. And one thing that I think came a little bit more to the fore during COVID, and this touches on some of the social media things we talked about in the last episode, was about post-publication peer review on servers like PubPeer and other places like that, where, okay, a paper gets out there and it's terrible and it may be completely invented, but eventually because it's out there, people look at it and it eventually gets found out. Is that in any way, shape or form a solution for our problems?
On the one side, it's just volume of data overwhelming is one aspect of that. And then on the other side of it, I just think it's risky that people will look at information like that who don't necessarily have expertise and then will take it at face value without putting that kind of effort into critically appraising what they're looking at. And at least with the peer review process that is in place at the moment, at least somebody is attempting to critically appraise the information before it is circulated to the general public or the, you know, general medical public or whatever.
So to wrap up, we can agree that peer review is the least worst option available to us at
all
the moment.
All I will say is my imagination is not big enough to come up with a different, a better alternative.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. And thank you very much for listening. And you can join us for future episodes of Respiratory Life here at the ERS Respiratory Channel. Thank you.